taxes and assign it to the Portland Water Bureau. Fritz?
Mayor, I actually have an amendment to propose a new proposed condition of approval for the vacation, which I've discussed with staff. There was, last week, there was some discussion that there would be four fewer parking spaces available because of the street vacation, and that was of concern to me in being able to support the street vacation. So I propose a condition of approval for the vacation that there will be four accessible off-street parking spaces preserved and labeled for park use, for use 7 days a week. And the future there will be further discussions on the best location and how to do this, which the staff has asked for. But I believe that the four parking spaces with minimal hours of use during weekdays in the afternoon and on weekends is necessary for approving this vacation.
Has the amendment been circulated?
I have not. If you want to second this for the purpose of discussion.
I'll second it. Moved and seconded.
This is the first I've seen the amendment. This is a project that was assigned to me by the mayor. It could quite possibly be something I could have considered, but what we heard last week from staff was flexibility when the project is actually completed to try to identify four or even more spaces, and I'm uncomfortable putting this condition in at this point until the project's completed. We know how many spaces we have. And
do you settle for legislative intent, or do you want to vote?
We hear from staff.
Yeah. Thank you. Dee Walker, Right-of-Way Acquisition. I've been speaking with Jim Coker, who's a supervising project manager from OMF, regarding this morning, and he would just like to have a little bit of time to work on language so our office and your office is comfortable due to a couple of different factors for the parking and how it's being labeled. There is different signs that are going up at the entrance of the parking lot, and he just wants to make sure that it can be used for visitor as well as for park purposes. So I just wanted to convey that today.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to express is I can't support an amendment at all, given staff represented last week that our intention is to try to identify adequate parking for guests at the park, and that I think it's premature to block out any amount for anybody for any reason at this point until the project's completed. But our intent, as well articulated last week by staff, is to do the best we can.
Right, and that is what Jim Coker said, that he would like to actually, no amendment, and actually do it later when it's actually being constructed.
Mayor Adams, I'm satisfied. This is a second reading. I'm satisfied. Even though I seconded the motion, I intend to vote no, that the legislative intent has been established and that the commissioner in charge has said he'd be willing to revisit this question. I believe we have enough in the record to proceed to the vote on the underlying ordinance.
As long as we have the legislative intent that four spaces are necessary to accommodate the lost off-street parking, then I can support the approval as written, and I certainly appreciate Dee and Jim, who have both been very helpful in addressing my concerns, and so I'm happy to have my office work with you on that.
Okay.
But
thank
I want
you.
To be Thanks. Crystal clear that when the project is done, if for some reason we determine that it's not possible to have four parking spots, there may not be four parking spots. I want to be clear about that. What we will try to do is manage the spots in a way to be able to create four or maybe even more, but I can't commit at this point, and I want that to be part of the record. We can't commit to this point to reserve any parking spots for anybody at this point.
Understood. And Jim Coker also had said that he needed to meet with other departments and department heads to determine this. He felt that there was a good chance, but that he also wasn't in a position to make it set right now as well, since there are other departments and other people that had to weigh in on this. But he thought there was a good chance that they could,
He is one to be loath to overpromise and is very cautious about. I think the legislative intent is clear.
I would like to withdraw my motion, and I also would ask Commissioner Fish, since it's a park use that we're talking about here, that if it turns out that we can't accommodate the parking on the emergency communications site, that you would work with the neighbors to figure out alternative parking for this.
Thank you. I would commit to that because I understand that the council's agreeing to make a good faith effort to reach the aspirational goal you've established without committing us to any particular plan.
Thank you.
So aspirational goal, our best effort, but we can't guarantee it. All right. So you've withdrawn your motion. You've withdrawn your second, and we're ready to proceed with the vote as part of a second reading.
Fritz?
Thank you to all the staff who are involved in this. Very helpful. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Well, I don't normally take a lot of time to explain my vote, but this I want to make sure everybody that's listening understands the import of this project. This is the culmination of not only a number of years of work to try to bring together all of the various emergency operations centers that currently exist on the west side of the river. In fact, the Portland Office of Emergency Management rent space on Southwest 6th, I think it is, Southwest 6th downtown. The Police Bureau has its own emergency communications center. Fire has theirs. BOEC has theirs. Water has theirs. PBOT has theirs. This action that we're taking actually is, I think, the final act the council needs to take to consolidate this piece of property that is behind BOEC that began with us purchasing houses back there two or three years back, removing the houses after we purchased them and creating a centralized emergency communication center that will allow for the city to, for the first time, have a central gathering place for the council in emergencies, for various entities in the city that have emergencies. And it also includes, was part of the bond that the voters passed in November, allocating $4 million to bring the last financing piece to construct the project there, which has been done very closely with the Bureau of Emergency Communications under Commissioner Fritz's portfolio. So this for me is a very exciting project, one that I'm hoping that the neighborhood finds complementary to the neighborhood, particularly if we can find ways to open up spaces for people to park. And if there's an opportunity to do more than four, I would want to do that. So thank you all for your support, and I vote aye.
Adams.
Well, it shouldn't go without saying that this wouldn't be before if it wasn't for the work, the leadership, the fundraising, the elbow grease of Commissioner Leonard with going out and putting together a bond measure for the voters to consider, raising money for it, campaigning for it, getting it passed, barely, but getting it passed. Win's a win.
It went by one.
Win's a win. And in the process of doing that, we're going to be a safer city. We're going to be a safer city without having to cut other very basic services in the city, in the rest of the government over the next 10 to 20 years, because we have to have this type of emergency communications. And, of course, a lot of those have to be housed in facilities, and that's what we're voting on here today. So change happens and improvements happen sometimes one piece at a time, like a mosaic, but this is actually a very big, good deal for the City of Portland. So thank you, Commissioner
Leonard.
Thank you
very much.
Aye. Can you please read the title for ordinance, regular ordinance, item number 168.
Establish a city policy discouraging employee use of personal scented products in the workplace.
Commissioner Amanda Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you to Anna Canwit from Human Resources. Many people can relate to the constant sneezing, runny nose, and itchy and watery eyes that pester some of us as the transition from winter to spring commences.
I certainly can right now.
Would you like a lozenge?
Yes, I would.
Always a healer.
That's right.
Always a healer.
According to the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, the AAAAIA, goodness gracious, approximately 50 million Americans suffer from some form of allergic disease like hay fever, asthma, and food allergies. Certain chemicals can also cause allergic reactions and asthma flare-ups for some people. Perfumes and fragrances are a combination of chemicals that can contribute to these allergic reactions, especially to those already suffering from allergies, asthma, or chemical sensitivities. And what's interesting about perfumes and fragrances is that they're considered proprietary, so there isn't a listing of what the contents are. I was not aware of this problem until I started working in City Hall. I have led a sheltered life in hospitals and schools where there's not a lot of fragrance use. And I have come to realize that there are some perfumes that I love to smell and I can continue to do so, and others that make me cough and unable to breathe, which is a significant impairment in my ability to concentrate on whatever the person who's talking to me is wanting to convey. So the symptoms can vary from upper respiratory problems, headaches, nausea, fatigue, and skin irritation, and these are well documented. We've received some comments about questioning whether this is in fact a real problem that needs to be addressed. I believe it does, and being the commissioner in charge of wellness, I believe that we need to have a city policy that discourages employees from using personal scented products while at the same time encouraging them to have a clean and good appearance and professional work attire, etc. We did hear some feedback from city employees about the discomfort that they experience in the workplace, which is what led me to investigate where other jurisdictions and organizations apply similar policies. Portland State University has a similar policy, and the Bureau of Emergency Communications is already fragrance-free because of the particular sensitivities. So I've been working with Anna in Human Resources in developing this administrative policy. Let me be very clear. This rule is not about telling city employees how to manage their personal lives. It's requiring employees to maintain a clean appearance, and we're not asking employees to radically change what they do. We are asking for everyone to be aware of the fact that some employees and citizens who visit us can be harmed by fragrance use. And with that, Anna Canwitt will tell us more about the proposed policy.
Thank you, Commissioner Fritz. Anna Canwitt, Assistant Director of the Bureau of Human Resources. The ordinance before you amends a current Human Resources Administrative Rule 4.03 on dress and appearance to add a new section on fragrance in the workplace. As you know, the Bureau of Human Resources is responsible for maintaining, revising, implementing the Human Resources Administrative Rules, which are binding policy on employees. A little bit of background on how we got here, although the Commissioner did an excellent job. Over the past probably 2 years, I have received feedback from some employees asking why we don't have any statement citywide about the use of fragrances in the workplace. So last summer, we, along with other revisions, I did send out some language to try and raise awareness of the fact, as the commissioner stated, that allergies to certain fragrances can cause serious health consequences in employees, and a reminder that as an employer, we need to look at reasonably accommodating those issues so that employees can perform the essential functions of their job. We pulled that change at Commissioner Fritz's request so that we could further look at this issue and determine what the best policy would be to bring forward. The research that we've done looking at metro area jurisdictions as well as the state of Oregon shows that while most follow an ADA model of accommodation, very few actually have an express policy. No one bans the use of fragrance, but very few have an express policy on this issue. We do have several city bureaus that have workplace rules governing the use of fragrance, but obviously not a citywide policy. So to the extent this is citywide, we are on the cutting edge, at least for the state of Oregon. Again, it's not a ban. It asks employees not to wear colognes, perfumes, aftershave, those products where the only reason you're wearing them is to emit a scent, and also asks that employees avoid strongly scented personal hygiene products. So we believe this has struck a balance between allowing most employees to continue to use the personal products they enjoy, but also recognizing that this can be a serious health issue for impacted employees. The other thing the policy does is it provides an explicit avenue for employees to come forward if they have an issue. We hope that that will encourage employees to talk to their supervisor if they're suffering from an allergy to fragrance in their work group. And what we found is that employees do need often to have that explicitly stated. If you have a complaint, go to your supervisor. You don't address it. You need to address it with your coworker. Your supervisor should take care of the problem. Equally important, if not more important, the reason for a citywide policy to address this issue is even if we have a particular work group, for example, the Records Division of the Police Bureau is fragrance-free, as those employees move perhaps to other city offices and bureaus conducting their work, they are exposed to fragrances that, again, can cause a damaging reaction. We did send the policy before you out for notice and comment to employees in December. Received quite a lot of feedback, I think over 100 responses, which is large. And the majority, I would say about three quarters at least, were very much in favor of moving in this direction. The last thing, just to bring up, I did send it to you in an email. We have drafted a question and answer document that, although it's not part of the binding policy, is an attempt to address some common concerns that employees have here. And so we think that will really help explain to employees why we're doing this and you know, what they can do to address their concerns or to ensure that their coworkers are not adversely impacted.
Here, I have a few questions.
Yes, sir.
Anna, you and I are working on some HR issues, and in the past we've talked about those things that have to be brought forward and changed through ordinance, those things that have to be bargained, and those things that we can just unilaterally implement. Can you tell me again why this comes before us as an ordinance and isn't just something that you can, in the ordinary course, implement?
Yes, Commissioner. Actually, let me back up a little bit. Council did delegate to Ken Rust, the Chief Administrative Officer, the authority to implement changes to the Human Resources Administrative Rules. We have drawn the line, obviously, where any change impacts compensation issues for employees, which would include, you know, vacation accrual, sick leave accrual, those types of things, because obviously that solely rests with council to determine. We also have kind of a gray area between what we would consider major policy shifts within the city and have tried to bring those forward to council as well. So this is really in that category. And had started out with us looking at a ban, which was not well received, and so the decision was to bring this back to council.
Second question is, you've drawn a distinction between an outright ban and the wording of this particular policy, which asks employees to refrain. So I guess one way of looking at that is, if you violate a ban, I assume there's usually disciplinary consequences. What is the consequence if you violate a request to refrain from some behavior?
There actually really isn't a consequence unless we have a specific situation in a workplace where we have an employee who's come forward who has an allergy to fragrances that's causing health issues for them in the workplace. At that point, it does become mandatory for that work group or, you know, whatever the segment of the employee population is. But what I think most importantly this does is we're asking people to really think about it. Wear your perfume at night and on the weekends. You don't need it in the workplace. And so we're really working to raise awareness of this issue.
Well, but if I might just jump in there with a further response to your question. First of all, one of the reasons we're bringing it to council is to publicize that this is the new policy and make sure that everyone agrees on it on the council. Secondly, that the previous wording or the lack of any wording in the policies before put the burden of proof on the sufferer to get doctor's notes and go through a process which wasn't clear that the supervisor had to do something about it. This policy now says that if somebody reports that they have a sensitivity, it's up to the supervisor to do something about it.
And Commissioner Fritz, I appreciate that distinction because I will tell you that I don't usually reveal this to people, but I am heavily allergic to certain kinds of perfume and makeup. So there, when I have guests in my office who have a lot of powder on and makeup and, you know, could be, I guess, men and women. I mean, just people who are could be, frankly, an actor. I have all kinds of reactions to it. My eyes get red. It affects my membranes. And for some reason, I'm allergic. I frankly haven't known what the protocol was to raise that with someone because it always felt to me somewhat presumptuous to tell someone, you know. And what I'm understanding then is under this policy, we're creating a climate in which you can feel less inhibited about telling someone that this does cause a problem and then working it out.
Absolutely. And, you know, along with the raising awareness would be talking about signage in offices, as we have in some bureaus and offices now, that this, because you can create a particular workplace is fragrance-free. If you choose to do that, so.
But I guess I thank you for your clarification earlier because I think there's been some misunderstanding of this particular mm-hmm. ordinance, and it's not a ban, it's not linked to our disciplinary policy, but it is an attempt to raise awareness and create a mechanism where people can talk about any allergies or reactions they have with a coworker, for example.
Correct, although we do encourage employees to go to their supervisor and manager. Most employees we found are quite uncomfortable bringing the issue to a coworker. Yeah. Not everyone, but a lot of people are.
Thanks very much.
Just one final comment before we take testimony. I note that I had discussions with Jeff Baer and the facility staff to examine ways to decrease fragrant cleaning products, and they are looking into that. That was some of the feedback we heard from employees, that why are we not dealing with that issue holistically, and so in fact we are.
That's good. Okay. All right. Who would like to testify?
We have three people signed up: Jason Worster, Barry Joe Stoll, and Jerry Jenkins.
Welcome back to the City Council. We're glad you're here.
Glad to be here.
I think you were first, weren't you?
Well, either way, it doesn't matter.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Please begin.
I'm here to share with my fellow Portlanders.
Your name first.
Oh, as if you don't know. My name is Jason Worster. I'm here to share with my fellow citizens of Portland what stinks about this confusing, repugnant aroma policy. This reeks of lack of leadership. Instead of providing coaching and professional development to workers who are having an issue, it appears that the city that works is to a point where conversations that city human resources finds tough or embarrassing are resolved with the threat of disciplinary action if one does not change the way they smell. It does not sound a place that I would want to work, as if any of you would hire me. But to help me better understand this knee-jerk wisdom behind this policy, can you clarify the following? How many serious health incidents have occurred over the past 5 years that has directly contributed to strong scents? Is this policy really masking the lack of cleaning of city buildings due to budget cuts many times over the past year? As I'm sure you know that several OHSU doctors have labeled the Portland building as a sick building, could this be the real problem creating asthma and heightened allergies? This appears to be a complaint-based policy that managers and supervisors are saddled with the burden of making sure that each of their direct reports daily pass the sniff test. Where can I find the process for official nose calibration so that one supervisor sniffer is not under or over registering? Does this include strong natural body odors occurring? And are employees safe from within the confines of a designated stink zone? Then there's the quagmire of an SBD, but I don't want to go there. On a serious note, last year Dan Saltzman was reported in the Oregonian about how vindictive one of his fellow coworkers is. Is there a review process that ensures that this policy is effective any more than providing mediation skills to empower employees to resolve their own issues? Or is this policy open to abuse? I give a hypothetical example. Samantha is furious at Danielle for standing up and supporting Rose. Samantha decides to be unethical and lie about Danielle's smell. How is Danielle to defend herself against Samantha's harmful, inappropriate tactic? Has anyone checked with risk management to see if there's any vulnerabilities in this process? By this time, is there any quantifiable scientific procedure for this policy based on parts per million or what actually is strongly scented? Or is this simply a quantitative-based process based on the oral factory of the offender? This is a poorly written policy that is the product of dysfunctional leadership and the same kind of lack of communication highlighted by outside reviewers that just pointed this out on page 339 of the comprehensive annual financial report. Last, I'd like to point out that the city ordinance applies only to city employees. You five are exempt, and that's wrong.
Thank you for your testimony. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
I guess I was signed up.
Mr. Stahl.
Yeah, Barry Joe Stahl. Sorry to hear about your allergies. As a person with an invisible disability, I'm heartened to at least see the discussion. As we've heard, there's some other opinions on how this should be handled. I just wanted to reinforce that, as was mentioned by the staff report, that the ADA does play a role here, and it would also be an employment matter separate to that under the Oregon civil rights legislation, which is interpreted and enforced by the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries Civil Rights Division. So there's two different sides of the coin. One is the just as this being a building that people come into that may have the same allergic reaction. There's the impact on them as this being a government building that would have to have those standards, just like we have ramps or buttons on the elevators that are accessible for people in wheelchairs, or the water fountains. So there's that issue, and I don't want to overrate the importance of the city recognizing that these other agencies have already taken action on this. We have the ADA. My personal experience shows how a lot of the disability legislation just is not at all enforced, nor is it enforceable, because we really have to have heinous experiences to draw the lawyers and such into the fray that would actually create the pressures to address these kind of social concerns. I'm glad that we have these infirmities that shows that we can have diversity. We have people with all types of abilities and disabilities, and I'm celebrating the attention to this matter. Just please don't create legislation that you be embarrassed by, and if you could, please rely on the existing state and federal legislation. Thanks.
Thanks, Mr. Stahl. Jerry.
Thank you. My name is Jerry Jenkins, and I've been an employee with the City of Portland for nearly 20 years. And I'm here today to support the ordinance that Commissioner Fritz has brought forward and that you are reviewing. I just want to share with you my personal experience around the issue of fragrance.
Could you move the mic just a little closer? Thanks.
Yeah. I'd like to share with you my personal experience around the issue of fragrance. 3 years ago, I began to experience severe and life-changing physical ills. My symptoms were extreme fatigue, chronic dizziness, chronic sort of brain fog, burning in my eyes, burning in my nose, and headaches. And after a lot of research and help, I found out that I was diagnosed with what's called multiple chemical sensitivity. What multiple chemical sensitivity is extreme sensitivity to the smallest amount of chemical you could possibly imagine. And I mean the smallest you can imagine, things you would never think you would respond to. If you're diagnosed with this and experience, you begin to respond to it. So the reason fragrance is relevant, Commissioner Fritz approached, is that fragrance is made up of chemicals. It's made up of dozens, if not hundreds, of synthetic chemical compounds. So if you have multiple chemical sensitivity, what I learned is the best way to get well, to regain my health, was to minimize my exposure. That was easy to do at home and in my personal life because I had control of my environment. It was much more difficult to do in the workplace because I had no control over the scent and product that other people wore. But I'm here today to testify to tell you that 3 years later, I am significantly better, and I don't remember the last time I had brain fog or I had chronic dizziness or even my eyes burned, because I work with people. Well, there's two reasons I'm better. One is that it's Portland, Oregon, and we have naturopathic care, excellent naturopathic care, and I found alternative health care professionals that told me what to do, and I got treatment. The other reason I work with a group that was supportive of me. In the Bureau of Transportation, from the PDOT director to my manager to my immediate group, people supported me. And around me, my little corner on the eighth floor of the Portland building became fragrance-free. My peers changed products, they changed habits, and they changed behavior to support helping me get well. And I did get well. It was not a big deal for them. And while people want to make this about something other than healthy air, they want to make it about employees don't communicate with each other. They want to make it about preferences or not. They want to make it about the long arm of government stepping in. It's simply about healthy air. This is an issue of an employer saying to all its employees, we want to provide you a healthy place to work. In doing so, we give you healthy air, you become healthy employees, you become productive employees, and it's simply good business sense to provide that opportunity for your employees. I could go on with one more example if you'll give me a minute.
Could you give us one more example?
I will. because there's been discussion about whether or not another city has brought this forward, I want to tell you about an article I read about the city of Detroit where a woman had asked her coworker to quit wearing heavy perfume. She had asthma, not chemical sensitivity, but asthma. And fragrance exacerbates many conditions, asthma, migraines, low-grade irritation to your sinuses. In this case, she asked the coworker. The coworker declined and continued to wear heavy scent. We work in cubicle environments here in the city and I'm sure in Detroit. She asked her supervisors. They laughed at her. They acted as if it was her issue. This is the article I read. Maybe some of they took liberty. But later, finally, she got a lawyer. And under the ADA, she, because it was affecting her asthma, which affects her ability to breathe, which affects her ability to live, under ADA, she sued the city of Detroit. She won $100,000, but they also had to implement the policy. The policy she had asked them to implement several years before. Had they simply done that, there would have been no lawsuit. The woman would have been able to work in a healthy environment. And I recognize that this is gentler language. This is not a ban. For me, it's a huge step forward because for me, it's bringing recognition at a public level to an issue that I've seen the news reports, I've heard the radio commentators, people are making fun of this right and left. But it's a serious, serious issue. It was a life-changing issue for me. And, you know, I am grateful to have my health back, but I still have to stay away from fragrance products. And I have to stay out of meeting rooms where people are heavily scented. So I really appreciate your effort here, and I appreciate, even though there's a lot of ridicule, I appreciate the attention to it, and I'm hoping that some of that will come forward in a way that the 10% of the population does experience this will be recognized. It's an invisible disability is what it is.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for testifying. Thank you. Anyone else wish to testify in this matter? All right. This is a non-emergency. So it moves to a second reading. Any final thoughts from anybody? Well,
thank you, Jerry, in particular, and other courageous employees who have stepped up in either privately or publicly to explain to people what this really means. And it is a serious issue, and it is something that affects the taxpayers of Portland because we need our employees to be at work and functioning as well as they can be, and we need them to not be using the city's health insurance, and which is paid for by taxpayers. So you might think it's a frills type of ordinance. It isn't, and it's important, even if it's for a few folks. I appreciate Barry Joe's testimony also in that some disabilities are invisible, and they are no less real. They are sometimes more difficult for people to recognize as necessary for accommodations. And this week we celebrated the one-year anniversary of the Portland Commission on Disability and recognized many of the advances that they've been able to make in just a short time. This is another step forward in that, and we all need to, I believe, be more thoughtful about the ways that we couch others' disabilities and indeed our own. Thank you very much for all of your work, and thank you especially to Anna Canwitt.
A clarifying question, if I might. One of the testifiers said city council was exempt?
Aren't we city employees? I get a paycheck.
No, we don't think you're exempt.
I didn't think so. So we're not exempt.
And Mayor, just also, so my understanding is council members are not exempt.
I understand.
This is not a ban. And there is no disciplinary trigger here. This is a request.
Mr. Worcester, how do you think we're exempt?
Who's your supervisor?
What's that?
Who is your supervisor?
The taxpayers of Portland.
Okay.
Okay, so 2 years from now,
we get
to get rid of that
statute. Okay, that'll be enough of that rudeness. But you and the city attorney agree that we are covered by this rule. I just want to be very clear on the record because it's the city attorney and you that decide.
Yes. I think we all, the city attorney and Bureau of Human Resources agree, and I think all the elected officials agree that you follow the binding human resources policies that are binding on all city employees. I think the distinction here that is causing some trouble is the fact that there is no discipline process, obviously, for you because you report to the voters. You're accountable to the voters as opposed to those of us who are accountable to you or employees who are accountable to supervisors.
But this does give the private right of action. If we are out of compliance, an employee could bring an action against a city council member.
Absolutely, because, again, it's been discussed with the Americans with Disabilities Act does govern these types of issues, health issues, and we're required to make accommodations.
And if I could just make a comment, I have had the opportunity to work with Jerry for however many years I've been here, and I didn't know that you suffered from this disability, but for those of you that don't know Jerry, she is as smart and as level-headed and as tough, hardworking employee as you will ever find. She is the furthest thing from what anyone could possibly describe as a whiner, weak, a complainer, a troublemaker. Nothing like that whatsoever. So, you know, frankly, Jerry, your testimony today and just your personal story is very surprising and puts a human face on it in the face of a lot of ridicule, and I really appreciate you coming forward.
Words.
All right, this moves to a second reading next week. Can you please read the title for procurement report, item number 169?
Mm-hmm. Accept bid of Stellar J Corporation for the Columbia Boulevard Wastewater Treatment Plant Chemically Enhanced Primary Treatment for $2,450,358.
Good morning, Ms. Moody.
Good morning, Mayor. Good morning, City Council. Christine Moody, Procurement Services. You have before you the procurement report recommending a contract award to Stellar J Corporation in the amount of $2,450,358. The city identified 8 divisions of work for potential minority, women, and emerging small business subcontracting opportunities. Subcontracting participation on this project at bid time was 13.1%, with work being performed in the areas of painting, insulation, masonry survey, concrete cutting, and trucking. Since the bids have closed, Stellar J has committed to using a women-owned business for some of the HVAC work, which brings their participation level up to 15.7% on this project. They are also looking for additional opportunities in underground piping and concrete work. I'll turn this back over to Council if there are any questions regarding the bidding process. Scott Gibson from BES is here to answer any technical questions, and Bob Kinghorn from Stellar J is also here if you have any questions of the contractor.
What's the headquarters? Where's the headquarters of Stellar J?
The headquarters of Stellar J. I'll ask Bob to come up here.
What's that?
Woodland, Washington.
Great. And this is obviously with the bid in hand, this is a high confidence transaction, right?
This is correct.
Not to exceed. Okay. Any other questions from council? All right, I'll accept a motion to accept the procurement
so
report.
Moved.
Second.
Been moved and seconded to accept the procurement report. Carla, can you please call the vote on the motion?
Fritz?
Thank you again for your good work. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. 169 is approved. Can you please read the title and call the vote for second reading, item number 170.
Authorize a contract and provide payment for construction of the Stark Inflow Controls Project, number E10003. Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. 170 is approved. Can you please read the title for resolution item number 170?
171?
Sorry, 171.
Authorize a temporary operating loan from the Bancroft Bond Interest and Sinking Fund to the Development Services Operating Fund to provide interim funding.
Commissioner Randy Leonard.
Director Paul Scarlett.
Good morning. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioner members. Paul Scarlett, Bureau of Development Services Director. I'm this morning in front of you asking for a loan, a reloan of a temporary operating loan from the Bancroft Bond Interest and Sinking Fund. The reason we're asking for this loan is a number of reasons. Quick background, March of 2010, almost a year ago, we asked for a loan to provide us the opportunity to essentially navigate the unpredictable aspects of our finances, and the construction activities, the economic crisis, the volatility, the uncertainty. We needed a loan to ensure that we were not, that we would be able to be operate at cash flow. And we wanted to make sure that in case we were not able to meet cost recovery, we'd have a loan to shore up any one day or one month of operating expenses. We're pleased to share with you that based on the major actions we took to balance our budgets, which included letting go, cutting more than 150 staff, we're in a position now that we're now operating at cost recovery and have seen that over the last few months. However, there are times when construction activities vary, and we may not meet cost recovery.
Just cash flow management?
Cash flow management. Our proposal is we are in a position right now to repay the loan that we borrowed last year, March, and given the uncertainty of what will happen in the out months, right now things are steady, but we don't have the necessary cushion to feel comfortable enough to not have a backup system, if you will, a loan. And so we're asking for the ability to pay back the loan along with the interest that's been accrued effective today, and would ask for a reloan that would be on the books or at least take effect tomorrow, February 17th. That would provide us the opportunity to sort of bridge the gap between this financial or fiscal year, which as the requirement for a loan is to be paid by the end of the fiscal year, so June 30th, 2011, and we're wanting to pay it back. Now we would have a loan on the books that would be, again, required to be paid the end of the fiscal year, so that would be June 30th of 2012. It really is, for us, we have determined a prudent financial measure to have in place to allow us to allow us to mitigate for any unforeseen financial shortfalls. That's essentially the gist of it. We are feeling very confident that based on projections and the economic recovery, which we're seeing some slight indication and anticipate come spring and summer, our Bureau will be in a position to operate at financial cost recovery basis on a regular basis and into the future. However, as you know, over the last 2 years, there's been huge fluctuations in the economy, so we just want to have a loan on hand in case some of these things are not realized. But we anticipate in the out years not having to have another loan, that we'll be in a better financial situation to rely independently on our own operating revenues, which is dependent mostly on permit fees. And there is a direct relation to construction activities, which is anticipated to be picked up in the next several years.
Mayor Adams, I have a few questions, if I could.
Yep.
Paul, for the benefit of people who are listening, could you describe what the Bancroft Bond Interest and Sinking Fund is and what the current balance is in the fund?
Maybe I can ask Denise.
Or it might be or Andrew Scott. Do you want to?
I know it is. We're able to repay it. But
Someone could give us a Bancroft 101.
Mm-hmm. That would be great. Thanks.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. The projected ending fund balance in this fund as of the end of this current fiscal year will be about $11.8 million.
And what's the source of those funds?
The source of funds are monies that are paid in on assessment contract payments that are the associated bonds have been paid off previously, and now those assessment payments are coming in and go into the reserve account.
And do we have any city protocols or guidelines or rules on what we can and cannot do with that money?
It's governed by charter. We've written a very recent memo covering this subject where we are recommending that the fund not be further reduced at this time. However, we approach this from the standpoint that a loan is different from a transfer out of the fund. So the our position is that this loan is fine. If it were a transfer out, a permanent reduction in the fund balance, we have some concerns about the ongoing level. So
the way this is described, the loan is to be repaid and then a new loan issued. So it begs the question, why not just roll over the existing loan an additional year?
Essentially that, well, under budget law, I believe we have to repay it in this year and then go through the process of reloaning it.
Effectively, that's what you'd be doing.
Exactly, yep.
And given what Director Scarlett has said is the need for this money, which is to provide a cushion with some uncertainty in your projections, why a loan and not, let's say, a line of credit? Why take the whole amount versus setting up a de facto line of credit and using what you might need?
We consulted with OMF as to the different options, and this was the one that was recommended. If you...
With the line of credit, Denise Klein, Bureau of Development Services. Excuse me. With a line of credit, there is a gap in terms of when we would receive funds. So for a line of credit, we would need to expend funds, pull together documentation, submit that documentation, and then receive reimbursement for that. And there's a 4 to 6 or so week gap between the time that the funds are spent and the time the funds are reimbursed. So that would actually contribute even more to cash flow issues than what we are requesting here with the loan.
And is the security for this loan just essentially a pledge against future revenues that you receive from permits?
Yes, it would be repaid through the revenues that's generated through permit activities.
And Paul, my final question is, have you projected in your budgeting for the next year the possibility that a school bond measure is successful and there are substantial permits and fees generated from that particular, the Portland Public Schools bond effort?
I'm not sure I can answer to that level of details. We have, based on projection in the meeting with economists, that will be 3 to 4% growth increase in activities that could accommodate. I did meet with the school district director, who's also planning on submitting some
documents that I think the mayor and I have seen. You know, they've done some projections off of what is a $500 million worth of construction mm-hmm. generate in fees and permits and SDCs. And
I should tell you, anything above and beyond would be great.
We take a very conservative approach projecting, and of course that's contingent upon voter approval, would not be part of our analysis. And that would just, at, as Paul just alluded to, it would just be way to the positive if that came to true.
And
fruition.
I guess my final question, thank you for the clarity in your answers. The risk here?
I think the risk here is if we don't get the kind of recovery that creates the cash flow that the Bureau is expecting, it could be a need down the road to reassess this loan. I should also point out we will be coming back in a couple of weeks with the line of credit request for the purchase of the permit tracking system as well.
Scheduled for next week. Wednesday, I believe.
So it also, yeah, go ahead.
What's the interest rate on the loan?
The interest rate on the internal loan is set at the city's investment portfolio yield, so there's no give up in yield either side. So right now, the loan rate would be a little bit in excess of 0.5%, but it's tied to the city's investment portfolio yield.
And where did the money revenues come from to pay back the first $1.5 million?
Each day, money comes in through construction activities, permit activities.
Can I get a breakdown of what those revenues are?
On a monthly basis, we have to bring in at least $2.1 million to match our expenses. That's happening now, and we have currently about $500,000 to $700,000 in reserve. We continue to monitor that closely, but all of our activities is dependent on construction activities. Some lien collections. We can provide you a breakdown. I'm not sure what level you would like.
I could also add to that the $1.5 million was put in our account and was drawn down a couple of times, but that money is in our account, is in our reserve right now.
So we currently have $1.5 in that reserve.
That's right. More than that. Right.
So I'm looking at information the DRAC was given, the Development Re-Advisory Committee, and it seems like staffing percentage change is -7% over the last year, but many of the other indicators, except for enforcement revenues, are down way more than that. So I'd like some more information on how your cash flow is working and on those projections.
I'm not sure what I'd ask, and I had to be a little bit careful about requests from offices to BDS because of the decrease in revenues and cut in staffing. You would think that if we laid over half the people, the workload dropped by half, and the revenue even dropped more than that, but that's not the case because we still get a lot of permits. They're just for low values. So I'm going to request of you, Commissioner Fritz, and anybody who wants to ask questions, please send them to my office first to the extent Sarah, who is my liaison, can answer them. I will have her do it. As a last resort, I call on the staff to do it because they are working oftentimes weekends and evenings just to keep up with their current workload. So if you have specific requests for information, we may have it to give to you in our office. If not, we will get it from them and then forward it to you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Is there anyone that wishes to testify on resolution item number 171?
No one signed up.
Please call the vote on item 171.
Fritz?
I appreciate your diligent work, and I do recognize that you're still battling the adversity of the recession, and I'll be in touch with Commissioner Leonard to get some more information in the meantime. I'm glad that you have the $1.5 to pay back, and it seems reasonable to have that cushion for your ongoing operations. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Thank you, Paul, and your whole team for managing us through this crisis, and particularly OMF for stepping in and helping us. It's been a lifesaver. Aye.
Adams.
Aye. Thank you. Approved. Can you please read the title for emergency ordinance item number 156?
Authorized agreement with Peregrine Sports LLC for usage of parking spaces in a surface lot.
Council, Hi. Can you give us an overview of what 156 is?
Surely. I'm Ruth Lane with the Bureau of Transportation, and it's simply an agreement to use parking spaces in a surface lot. The lot is owned by TriMet and operated by the city. I manage the lot. It's for 25 spaces at the current monthly rate.
Any questions from council? This is an emergency ordinance, so I need one more vote. Anyone wish to testify on 156?
I would.
Please come forward.
Thank you. My name is Jason Worcester. About almost 3 years ago, working on Commissioner Fritz's campaign, I learned about what emergency ordinances were and the consent agenda. From reviewing Emergency Ordinance 156, I see that the need of the emergency is based on signage being placed up by April 1st. I don't agree that's an appropriate use of the emergency ordinance. Furthermore, this parking spot, or parking lot, should I say, comprises about half a block at 18th and Salmon for Mayor Paulson and Peregrine. It's being given away at the rate of about $5 per day per spot. I don't think that is a realistic price for someone to have exclusive rights for 25 parking spots of prime space next to PG Park at that rate. So I ask that this be further reviewed to see if the monthly rate for this lot for 25 spots for about $5 a day might not be appropriate, and if the city taxpayers are not getting the maximum yield off of such a prime piece of property. As we know, parking is probably one of the hardest things to do in that part of town. I appreciate you revisiting this and also understanding my dismay at the use of an emergency ordinance and placing something like this on the consent agenda.
Thank you. So just to make sure I understood your presentation, this is property owned by TriMet, who has contracted with us to manage it, and you are the manager.
I am. It's
And it's the cost per spot is set by market?
It's just a market area study.
Okay.
That we do pretty much annually.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that use is not going to be for PGE Park events. That's separate. This is just for weekdays.
So it's for the rehabilitation center?
Yes.
Okay.
So the monthly rate is 150? 110.
But that's Monday through Friday.
Eight to six.
That's what the permits are in that lot. It's for businesses in the lot.
So that, for example, is above what you would pay for parking at the lot that's in the River District next to
our garage.
Yeah,
that advertises I think $90 to $95, and it's less than the full freight at a number of downtown lots that are closer to 150 or more. So this rate was arrived at by looking at using it 5 days, not 7 days, and then based on a market study?
Right. And it's not downtown. It's not, you know, it's only during commuter hours, and it's on the other side of the freeway.
So it's intended to, as was alluded to in earlier agreements and conversations, this was part of the overall deal, but they had to do it at market rate. But the rehabilitation clinic, which is on that side of PG Park, needs access to parking. I'm pleased to see this move forward because I've also had calls from some of the businesses around the new rehabilitation center that are afraid that the rehabilitation center clients will crowd out their customers. So any additional discussion? All right. Carla, would you please call the vote on item number 156?
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. 156 is approved. We just have one more. Is 158, does it need to be amended?
Yes.
Okay. Can you come forward? We'll do this really fast if we can.
158. authorize the Bureau of Transportation to execute a temporary construction easement with Multnomah County, a political subdivision of the state of Oregon, as part of the St. John's Pedestrian Freight Project.
So what is the amendment that needs to be moved?
I'm Marty Maloney with the Bureau of Transportation right away. And basically the amendment that needs to be in place in the ordinance would be a obligations agreement the Multnomah County is requiring putting into the easement itself. So it's just changing the exhibit in the ordinance. Okay. So nothing else has changed.
So the change is at the request of Multnomah County Legal Department.
Exactly.
Okay, I move it.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion on it?
Do I have it in writing?
Oh, yeah. Oh.